Frank McGuinness is one of our most famed and honoured writers. His plays include Observe the Sons of Ulster Marching Towards the Somme, Carthaginians and Someone Who'll Watch Over Me, along with adaptations of European classics such as his version of Ibsen's A Doll's House, which won a Tony Award. He is also the author of two novels and several collections of poetry, the most recent of which has just been published. It's called The Wedding Breakfast, and Frank McGuinness joins me in studio. Frank, the wedding breakfast of the title is some event. It's a very strange location and it has a strange collection of guests. Would you tell us, where did the poem come from?
It has a very specific source, unlike a lot of poems. My partner, Philip, we've been together about 40 years. We're not married, but he had to go through very serious heart surgery about 3 years ago. And so he was under the knife and under heavy drugs. He went into a coma for 8 days as a part of the recovery process. And when he came out, he had very strong fantasies, hallucinations. And one of them was that we had actually got married in the ward, in the cardiac ward. And nothing could persuade him for that. So we had to go along with it for about 3 or 4 days until he finally realised that this was a dream. And that was really the root of the poem, this dream that Philip had, that we had tied the knot together in the cardiac ward and had the wedding breakfast in the hospital.
Great, we can't wait to listen to it.
Okay. We married last September in Belfast, the cardiac unit, Royal Victoria. Your heart surgeon said he'd do the honours. I hear tell he was Greek, some Apollo. He fancied himself another Dylan, blood in the tracks like blood on the lancet, strumming your flesh with his swift fingers, singing you safely home from the dying, troubadour playing the pipes of your breath. He phones to tell me it was near enough. I dare not ask near enough to what. We dread to think, but must face the music of what could have happened so near, so far. And here's me thinking, where should we both be? Might we not have larks swimming on the moon, some lunar crater where bees gather honey, sweetened by poison, spilling like mercury, drenched in the yellow blood of foxgloves, an eye for an eye, a man for a man, taking the plunge in a hospital ward? Who made up the numbers of our wedding party? What happy families, what foes or friends? Who gave us gifts of cat's tails and eggshells? Who played xylophones on my lover's shin bones? What mad bastard suggested we do that? Needles administer the wedding breakfast, a champagne reception of Lucozade. One groom wore the best of black pyjamas. Our bridesmaid, the kind nurse from Hong Kong, she who was wise as Jacob's Rebecca. What did she make of our cracked Kayleigh Moore? Who did she phone when she finished working? Where was the sport, lads? What was the story? Did she belong to a church of elders demanding she shun all contact with queers? Rewriting the Bible in Mandarin, reciting Solomon's song in Shanghai, taking the piss out of Leviticus. She brought us two rings connecting Cladders through Chinatown, Soho, weeping for Ireland. Her boyfriend in Dublin had done the dirty, a gazelle leaping over the Great Wall. No chance of her walking down the aisle, no more than ourselves till that lucky day. We went on a bender in Belfast City, pledging our vows in that hospital ward, risking the lives of our immortal souls, the revels of fertile love between men, enraptured in the Royal Victoria, surviving heart surgery, sacred as gold.
The Wedding Breakfast there from the Wedding Breakfast new collection of poems by Frank McGuinness. It would be hard to match that with a real wedding breakfast.
No, I think we could let that in fantasy, actually. Yeah.
So, as you said, the whole collection is dedicated to your partner, Philip.
Yes.
And the man in the morphine haze here that you so well describe. And you, too, have suffered ill health in the...
Yeah, it has been a rough few years for both of us, actually. I was... laid up last year for the first time in my life. I was in hospital and I had to have 6 weeks in the clinic. It was a terrible shock to the system, but In one way, I was so ill that I really couldn't fight it. I just had to take what was put in front of me and get through it and try to survive it.
Has it affected the way you write, either how you approach writing as much as the volume of writing?
Oh, it has affected me in every way, actually. I mean, I really had to work hard to get my concentration back, my powers of concentration. And I also really have... I live with pain now. That's the big difference between before the illness and after it. I just live now with pain, and that's life.
And how do you fit in your writing then with such physical impediments?
Well, I've tend to concentrate on the poems, I had a commission from the Abbey to do Tartuffe, the great play by Molière, which I managed to get. I got that done. And that was quite challenging and quite hard, but I'm content to simply work on short poems or long poems and try to get them finished and get a coherent whole from them. I know that it's taken its toll, and I'm too scared to ask how big a toll it's taken, but I certainly know that my energy levels have been depleted badly, and my ability to walk for miles on end is gone, which is a terrible loss to me, actually. But you live with it, you're alive, and that's the way of getting older.
I think the illness that you've experienced, and also writing about Philip's illness, has in some way brought you closer to your father, who is a strong presence in this book.
Yes.
I mean, we would know from plays like The Factory Girls how important, of course, your mother was.
Yes, my mother and my aunts and my grandmother, they are very powerful presences on nearly everything that I've written. But my father really has not figured as powerfully as he should have, or one way, or as he could have. And I feel that maybe that, like everything else that happens, there's a reason for it. And I think maybe the time was right. The time was waiting for when he would become a dominant voice or a dominant image in what I do write. It certainly happened in this, which I have no doubt about that. And part of the reason, I think, is because I think any kind of severe illness or any near fatal illness, you inevitably become aware of your frailty and your fragileness. And I think at some level I was looking like a child to my father for some strength, for some protection that I'd hoped he would give me, even if it's only on the psychic level. So that's why I feel he is so much more powerfully present in these poems.
There are a number of poems about your father, but I think you're going to read one called Trains.
This is the first poem in the collection. It's called Trains. That could be me, the red-haired man, leading his child, his red-haired child, down the aisle of the moving train, travelling to Belfast, the child by the hand, the boy looking at the back of his father, holding each other by fingers and thumbs, passing secrets on to each other, secrets they'll tell to the end of days, tucking each other into the clay, reading stories passed from finger to thumb, stories that began, that end on a train, moving to Belfast, travelling from Dublin, where somebody says to himself, that could be me, the red-haired man, leading his child, his red-haired child.
There are a lot of red-headed people
there are indeed,
in this collection.
From a tribe of redheads with tempers to match, actually.
And there's a lot of going back into Buncrana and your childhood there, and talking about the things and the images, but also actual things or implements that meant a lot
yes,
to you.
Yes, yes.
Now, the jawbox is one. Now, I think if you might just read maybe two stanzas
of it. I will,
it.
Actually.
But just tell us, what is a jawbox?
A jawbox is a sink. That's what we called it in my grandmother's house in Buncrana in the Pine Lane. Everybody had a jawbox. It was a council house, and the only running water was the tap and the scullery. And in the scullery there was the sink, and we called it the jawbox. I'll read you a couple of stanzas for it. With our finest china, I filled the jawbox, lending a hand, doing as I was bid. The best laid plans and other commodities, how could I know scalding water cracked it? Who'll stick together smithereens and shards, the willow pattern's mystic sorrow? I leaned stupefied against the jawbox, hearing the news we'd won the war. I'd witness once more the last of our name, stand where I stood, cleaning his hands, his bones, soap twisting his eyes, face on a towel, scraping from his soul vice and vanity. Shirts he wore working doused in the jaw box. They would never learn to hold the tongue. Pumping for news who made our daily bread, bakers or butchers' delivery men. My hands could read buttons, collars and cuffs. Wonder they grew rough learning such language.
Yes, and in the next chapters, there's thing about the red-haired and roaring children get to end up there. There's a lot of travel in this collection. Yeah. Real and imagined, I think?
Mostly entirely imagined. I'm the world's worst traveller. As I was saying, you know, somebody once said, I can't go to Bray without having somebody to meet me, to bring me to the main street.
Yes, because there's a poem called Vietnam. We don't have time to read it now. But what you do is you use the imagery of Vietnam juxtaposed with imagery of the Troubles.
Yes, juxtaposed with my own life coming to Dublin, moving south. And the background, the political background, apart from the North, of course, was that the war in Vietnam was raging. So it invariably informed my thinking about myself and becoming an adult and becoming some way aware of the political realities in the world.
Well, Frank, congratulations with your new collection. It's called The Wedding Breakfast by Frank McGuinness, and it's published by the Gallery Press.